Support for this episode is brought to you by SipTequila.com. They just opened up a brand new retail store that has a special room that they call their Tequila Vault. They have been saving special bottles for the past few years and now are starting to offer these to the public. Make sure you sign up for their mailing list so you know when these releases happen. That's SipTequila.com. Premium brands ship direct to your door. The word passion refers to a strong feeling of enthusiasm or excitement either for something or about doing something. For many of us, what we do for our day job usually doesn't line up with what our passion is. My guest today, as a trained chemical engineer, woke up one day and realized it was time to not just simply do a job, but have passion for what he was doing. And with that, PM Spirits was born, curating and creating some of the finest spirits we can get our hands on. We're going to hear his story and try their incredibly small batch Tequila Blanco on this episode of the Agave Social Club Podcast, hosted by me, Doug Price. Welcome to the show. This is the Agave Social Club Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Price. Today, we're going to be diving into PM Spirits, provider of geeky spirits with founder Nicholas Palazzi. Nick, welcome to the show and thanks for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'm humbled that you reached out. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. PM Spirits is an importer and distributor of specialty spirits. Last year or so, you launched two incredible Blancos under the name PM Spirits. But before we get into those, why did you create PM Spirits?
How much time you got? The story might be a little long. I'm going to try to make it digestible. You may hear, I've been working on it, but you may hear that I have a slight accent. So that is because I am born and raised in France, in Southwest France, in Bordeaux. And I'll give you the brief background that will likely help you understand why we're doing what we're doing right now. Essentially, I grew up in a winemaking family, but like nothing crazy, like, you know, in Bordeaux, but not like the big Bordeaux Grand Cru, small vineyard owners, €3 table wine type stuff. Ended up being pushed by my family to do engineering studies. So I ended up with like two majors, one in physics and one in chemistry. But I'm not trying to flex any of these majors because I wasn't that great. My engineering score was sort of average. But where I'm getting to here is that I never really thought about what I wanted to do. And I've always kind of done what my family pushed me to do. So worked in France as a chemical engineer. And a few years into it, kind of felt a deep sense of really hating what I was doing.
Okay.
And disliking the people that I was doing that stuff with. So I ended up looking for something else that I should be doing. I met a friend at the time who she was living in New York City and said, "Hey, you never really traveled. You never seen the US. Maybe you want to come check it out." So I did that. We started dating. I quit that job in France, moved to New York City in 2004. But I wasn't, as I told you, I'm not that smart. So I had still not understood that engineering wasn't for me. I ended up managing a medical research lab, human embryonic stem cell research stuff in the Bronx. Did that for a little bit and was back at, being unhappy with what I was doing professionally. And that's when it kind of hit me that I should probably, just stop and think about what I would want to do.
Yeah.
Kind of stuff that you want to be passionate about, the kind of stuff that, you wake up in the morning and you're pumped to do what you're going to do. You want to, you may work 16 hours today and sleep five, and then you wake up and you want to do it again.
Yeah.
And because I didn't want to feel miserable again. That's how I posed and thought, all right, what do you like? And I like wine. I like spirits. As I said, I grew up in that little winemaking family. So I kind of knew how the stuff was made, hands-on type of experience. As I was living in the city, I know that I was blown away by the selection, the depth of selection at the corner store, wine shop. That wasn't great by any means, but I was like, wow, everything from every region producers. And I remember thinking, the spirits game is kind of lame because it's just, it's super branded. So I put all that stuff together in my small head. I realized that I had some family connections with like artisanal cognac makers. And I thought, all right, well, maybe I could try to bring to the US some of that artisanal booze that I liked. And in 2011, I started a PM, which was me. And that's pretty much it. At the time, it felt kind of right. You know, like the food network was like people were watching that stuff. Farm to table was a thing. And I don't know, just like doing a thing around artisanal spirits and bringing in artisanal spirits sounded like the right move.
And when you started, was this pretty much all from France? Going back to Cognac, Armagnac, the relationships you had, or were you starting to bring in spirits from all over?
I started on my own with three cognacs from three different families, which I knew, because I had no business plan nor understanding of the three-tier system or network or anything. My grand idea was to bring in things that were rare and old and really good and not cheap, because I was like, VS, VSOP, I don't want to touch that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the big brands are doing it. And so in that, I had a very unrealistic mindset. And on top of that, I thought, hey, what I could do is source rare stuff, like rare casks of cognac, because I started with just cognac. And, you know, like find that stuff, put that in a small cellar that I would rent or something. And then also be like an independent rare cognac bottler. And all that living in New York City, which makes no sense whatsoever. Like that shit is dumb. Like these are very different jobs. To be an independent bottler somewhere, you need to like live there. You need to be in the cellar. You can't. So in my head, I would be doing exactly what you just said. Like I would, you know, like be in New York, sell stuff, travel to France, find things, borrow things, bring them back to New York, sell them. That did not work out. That's not feasible. So I was based in New York.
And that, like the cognacs that you were bringing in and those families that you knew, did they have any presence here in the United States, or they were just selling locally or around France and didn't really have any US, I mean, you know, distribution or anything, but you were bringing that for the first time to the US?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much stuff when you look at Europe and a lot of other places, but like initially looking at Europe, you have a lot of small distillers and they quote unquote survive thanks to very random markets. Like they don't have a strategy. They're not imported. They're not imported in like 37 countries. Like they will have oftentimes the person in charge right now is like the second, third, fifth generation distilling. And say like the dad or the grandfather at some point did a like trade show somewhere and met somebody who happens to have like three stores in Belgium. And all of a sudden, like this little, you know, distillery, be it Cognac, Armagnac, or whatever, they have an outlet in the three stores in Belgium. And that's how these little guys tend to make a living. Like they have a patchwork of customers. Nothing is really planned. It just happened organically. None of the people I started with were in the US. And I just took it upon myself to try to find fellow enthusiast who would give me the time of day and you know, taste the stuff and see if they liked it.
And I heard that, you know, there's a family friend of your grandfather. He is referred to as Mr. X. Who is Mr. X? I think he was a cognac producer, but he was someone that kind of took you under his wing or helped mentor you a little bit in this. And that's what helped you launch PM Spirits to go, hey, this is something we want to bring in. What can you tell me about Mr. X?
Well, I can't tell you who it is because there's a reason why I can't name it. Otherwise, I'm going to step into a word of shit, if you pardon my French.
Okay.
But what I can tell you is that I've been raised half by my grandparents and half by my mom. And my grandfather had three best friends, and they had served, they went through like the mandatory military training in France in the 50s. And they were like sharing like a bedroom, the four of them. And one of them was a cognac maker, like coming from a known family of cognac makers, small guy, renowned for his skills and with a very strong personality. And so this dude was coming to our place on, you know, for Sunday lunches, or we would come to his place. Like there was like this sort of a, like my grandparents and him were pretty tight. And so I never realized the impact that childhood stuff might have, but I've seen wine cellars, I've seen cognac cellars when I was young, just like not trying to see them, but just like being around people who were involved in that business. And so when I was trying to think about what I would want to do for a living after the engineering gig, like all these things sort of like reappeared in my mind, and it felt like it made an imprint. So that dude, my grandfather's best friend, was was what they call in French, a bouilleur de cru, which is like the name for artisanal distiller. And he's the guy who showed me around initially, kind of took me a little bit under his wings and just hung out with him. And he introduced me to some people. But mostly by talking to him, I got to learn stuff about the trade and stuff about, you know, cognac making, distilling, aging, blending, bottling that I would not have necessarily been able to touch. Yeah. Without having that direct connection to somebody who was like actually making the stuff with his own hands.
Gives you a little bit of that foundation to go, yeah, I can do this. I've got an inside look at it. So after Prohibition was repealed, the U.S. sets up the three-tier system, as you were learning about that as you were starting, where, you know, we've got producers or importers, and then they sell to distributors, and then they sell to retailers, and then those retailers sell to us, the consumer. I mean, there is a system here. PM Spirits at the core, they search out or create to find the best small batch spirits, whether that's, you know, cognacs, rums, tequilas, agave distillates. Can you break down a little bit of the role of an importer? You know, I've got a lot of people that listen to the show and we talk about tequila brands and we go through the process, and we'll do that with your tequila. You have a fantastic tequila. But since I have you as an importer, I want to see if you can educate us a little bit on the role of the importer. What are those steps? I mean, as you were getting into it, you said earlier, I didn't know a lot about all of that. So I'm sure there's a lot of learning as you go. But what are some of those steps, and what did you learn as you're on that journey to become an importer, to be bringing in spirits from, you know, all over the world to the U.S.?
Well, I think that, I mean, for me, not coming from the U.S., I did not realize how complicated it would be to touch booze. Had I done this in France, France is it's much easier to deal with spirits, because I could, there's no three-tier system, and I could put stuff in the mail and send it to you. This is our three-tier system here is vastly different. So the importer's game is it's several fold. You need to have a good understanding of legalities and the logistics of things, because that's the basics. You need to make stuff happen. So if you suck at any of these, it's just like there's no business. That said, these things, the beauty about the US is that there will be somewhere a company that you can outsource that stuff too. So this is it's an immense help when one is starting a business and one is not really sure about what one is doing, to find somebody or company who is going to help you out with the compliance, logistics, and stuff. A lot of people tend to feel that this is going to be the main issue. Like, how am I going to find containers to put stuff in, and how am I going to do with the labels? I would tend to say that this is that's the easy part, because, you know, you can outsource it to people who are very good at it. Now, you the role of the importer, I think, at least in my mind, the role of the importer is to A, source products that are unique in a way that one really believes in. Curate a portfolio, and the word curation is I mean that word. I realize like a lot of people are using the word curation. It's like small batch, and nowadays it doesn't mean anything anymore. But I think that it's I want to think that we are really curating an offering. We are very selective as to the type of stuff that we add to the portfolio. And ideally, I think that the importer has a precise curated portfolio of things that kind of make sense, where there's like a common narrative between the different distillers or winemakers or whatever that is that one may want to import, to be able to tell a story to somebody who may want to hear it. The third part, after the finding the supplier and understanding how to get the stuff to the US, is to sell it. And as a matter of fact, that's the hardest part.
Yeah,
the logistics is easier. The supplier side, so many people are making stuff out there. It's technologies, like the advances of technology and communications are such that it's really hard to make products that suck. So there's supply. There are a lot of supplies out there, like a lot of people making good stuff. Selling is the hard part. Everyone is, the market is pretty saturated. Everybody is trying to sell stuff on the US market. Everybody is trying to kind of sell to the same people. It's essentially, especially in the artisanal spirits game.
Yeah.
There's a finite amount of buyers. There's a finite amount of people who really care.
Yeah, and finite amount of shelf space.
That's right. And so I think the hard part is to create those meaningful connections with the buyers and the early adopters and whoever would want to give you the time of day and listen to your story and taste the stuff and gain, you know, people's trust. And have a compelling enough story that people want to be like, all right, I'll give you 2 minutes. I'll try it out. I'll listen to you a little bit, and hopefully they taste what you have, and it talks to them. They like it, and they may even want to buy it. Who knows?
Well, it sounds like from an importer, and it seems as if you are able to source some of the not as fun or sexy parts of the job, because I'm sure there's a lot of permitting and things that, you know, a lot of paperwork, documentation to be bringing alcohol to the US. There is a lot of documentation and things. I've talked to brands and going, hey, trying to get product over, you know, over the lines into the US, but you're able to source some of that. But then there's this idea of, like you said, you're curating different spirits, and, you know, PM Spirits to me has an edge to it. I mean, and I think the selling point for wanting to try other things is I try this tequila and go, whoa, this is fantastic. I know the mezcals or agave distillates that you're involved in, and they're incredible. So that makes me automatically go, I want to see what they're doing in the whiskey world, or I want to see what they're doing in the rum world, because you guys have already built that loyalty of, hey, they're small batch, really going to, I mean, I love this idea of putting together a collection to go out and either find or collaborate and source small batch, whether that's whiskeys or tequilas, rums. I have a buddy who's a big whiskey guy, and I sent him one of your whiskeys, and I said, hey, tell me about this. And he said, it's legit. It's legit. And I'm going, okay, so that just tells me, I mean, you guys aren't just going out to go, hey, let's get a whiskey, let's get a rum, and let's try to bundle this all up. You guys are really going to tell a story, and you're going all over the world. What is it that you're looking for? Because I know you're not creating, you know, with PM Spirits, the tequila, you guys helped source this, you created this brand, but I'm sure some of the other ones that you bring in and import, they may have already been in existence, just not here in the US. But what is it that you're looking for when you're looking to partner with a producer or a brand to bring in to get them to the US?
There's several aspects to your question. I'm gonna try to go one by one quickly.
Sorry,
I don't
want
to bore your listeners. No. These are very good questions. So the first part that I want to address is the fact that we do, so PM, there's two businesses within PM. There's an import business and there's a New York wholesale business. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is because you'll understand that it's why it's relevant. So the import is bringing products to the US and selling it to wholesalers. And as you said, those wholesalers are going to sell that to like the bars and restaurants and retails. And so we do that in New York State, where our team sells to bars and restaurants and retail. So that's one thing, just one building the context here. There's a second thing that I want to mention for better comprehension is the idea that we deal with three different types of products. There's the basic, I would say, the basic import business, which is taking a product that is made by somebody under this person's own brand, and bringing it to the US, and so importing it, and then wholesaling it and selling it to bars, retails, and restaurants. There's a second aspect, which is doing joint projects with distillers, people that we either import or people who we don't import, but we like them. We have ideas. There's stuff that we would want to do with them. And it could be, like picking a single barrel, or it could be blending a bunch of barrels together. It could be, thinking, well, they have this lineup of stuff. It's amazing. But we know from an import perspective, or maybe from a New York wholesale perspective, that we could use this thing. And we could use like a foolproof Armagnac to put into cocktails. Something that's 50%+, something that's really cool. It's not on the market. Something that has no additives to it. Like something that could be drunk neat, but also could make bowler cocktails. And the distillery is not doing that because I don't know. Like they don't have a market for it. They never thought about it. Whatever the reason is. And so we're gonna do those joint projects, and oftentimes it's done under or collabs. And this is done under a label that we may have developed oftentimes. And then there's the third aspect to our business, which is doing our own projects, like creating our own labels, our own brand, so to speak, even though we're not really creative brands. And this is like making product that don't exist under packaging and a label that we own. So that's just to set the context. What we, and you were asking what we're looking for in terms of products.
Yeah.
And how we're selecting things, correct?
Yeah, like have you ever been somewhere or somebody from your team? Because you do have a great team. Have you been somewhere and you've tried something and you thought, oh my gosh, this is special. We need to try to figure something out here. Because I'm sure you're telling that story. You're going, hey, where's this coming from? Who's making it? What's the process of it all? So what are there parameters or things that you kind of go checklist and go, yeah, this could fit into our portfolio?
I never had a plan, and 12 years in, we still don't have a plan, okay. Which is not really, it's not super reassuring, but the reason why I'm saying that is because we've never really thought, A, we need to have like 3 cognacs, 4 Armagnacs, 7 tequilas,
yeah.
Or we need to have a gin and this and that and the other to cover all categories. It never happened that way. It's most of it is about wanting to represent good stuff. Most of it is about like the idea, the hope that one day PM will be like trusted by the person who may be into booze, turn around the bottle, know nothing about that specific product, whatever that is, a specific distillate, sees that we're involved to some degree and think, all right, if these guys are involved, it's probably not going to suck too much. I'm gonna trust these guys with my $50, $100, or whatever. The goal has never been to hit every single price point, every single categories. I've never set myself to go look for stuff. But as you're doing something and you have some sort of an idea of the thing that you're doing, as you're not deviating from that path, then you end up meeting people.
Yeah.
And you end up having people reach out and we say, hey, like, have you seen this? Have you talked to that person? Like this, like these people, like you would like them. I think that you guys are like-minded individuals. And this is how little by little the portfolio, whether on the import side or the wholesale side, grew. But it never grew. It never grown because there was a need to increase volume, sales, or hit specific targets. So as to how it grows, what we're looking for rather, I think there's three steps. There's a first one, which is we're dealing with booze. We're dealing with something that you ingest, something that directly talks to your mind. Your palate and mine. So I think that the first step is whatever booze we're involved with, like we want it to click. We want it to have a personality. We want it to, like, I want that stuff to talk to me. I want my brain for some reason be like, oh shit, this is cool. Like if that happens, and it could be because of the flavor profile, because of the texture, because of how it evolves on the palate, or just like, I don't know, something. It checks a first box. I think the second aspect is understanding how that stuff's made and try to get a sense of whether it's kind of like true to type, whether it really represents like a know-how, a sense of place, like the terroir type stuff that the French talk about. And as one is understanding how that stuff's made, you know, understanding whether like corners are cut or not, because we're not interested in peddling stuff that's been, you know, manufactured. Or
yeah, you guys are into high quality. I mean, even just what you're doing, tequilas is confirmed additive free. I mean, you guys are really into the best of the best, not just in tequila, but all your spirits, it looks like.
We think that the consumer, the person who cares about booze, will care about a product that expresses somebody's vision, a sense of place, that expresses the raw material that it's made from. And that can't translate if the stuff is covered in additives. If that color is not real, if there's a bunch of sugar added to it, there's a bunch of, you know, flavoring and whatnot, like what's the point? Like these products, they already exist anyway. So we're looking for the unadulterated version of like specific distillate. And I think that over the years we added a third tenet, which is not only should the stuff talk to the brain and be cool in a way, have a sense of place and be additive free and stuff, but it also should be made by good people. People you want to work with, like good humans.
Yeah, and people that you can tell a story from. You can, you know, bring in their story because they're the ones producing it. So people that you want to go, hey, I want to hear their story.
And that story, like, because you're absolutely right. And you know that this business is all about, it's all about like human connections, yeah. Right? There's only one way that you can possibly sell a product that no one knows about, that nobody needs, that is not a brand that anybody has heard about. Like there's only one way. It needs to be good. You need to be genuinely interested and genuinely like the stuff and want to transmit that enthusiasm, want to transmit that story to somebody, and that your genuine enthusiasm is going to be the thing that's going to make the person believe.
Yeah.
And that can only happen if you really like the product and if you really like the people. Because otherwise you have to, if the product is amazing, but it's made by somebody who's a douchebag, it's going to be so hard to tell a story. You're going to be like, oh, you should meet so-and-so. He's so great. And in your mind, you're like, all right, this is the most horrible person I've ever seen. Like, it's not going to work out. I think you need to check these different boxes to do a decent job at selling these products that nobody's waiting for them. There's no demand. And if they did not exist, like, no one would care. So
yeah, people don't know that they need it. You've got to try to convince them that you need this because this did not exist in this space or in this state or this liquor store or bar before I walked in with a bottle of it. So I'm sure there are some challenges to convince them. But like you said, I mean, looking and going, oh, PM Spirits. I mean, that excites me to want to try the different. I mean, there's like an anthology. There's a collection of different spirits that get your stamp of approval or the PM Spirit stamp of approval. And that makes me go, hey, I want to try that because I really like what they're doing in the tequila space. You know, now we get to PM Spirits Tequila Blanco. What was it that made you guys go, hey, we probably want to get a project going with a tequila, and we're going to kind of get into that, because I know you guys worked with Jose Luis Gutierrez, but why was it that made you go, hey, we want to add a tequila to the portfolio?
Well, there's several things here. The first one is, I think one wants to understand that we're not coming at this from a brand standpoint. Like, there's no grandiose plan on creating a brand that we will then sell for a bunch of millions or whatever. Like, we're not into the brand building thing. We're seeing things from an import and a wholesale perspective. And for the longest time, we didn't have a tequila, whether it's import or wholesale in New York. And everybody would be like, all right, the cognac stuff's cool, the Armagnac's great, but like, you know, yeah, agave things, and we'd be like, no, we don't. But, you know, we got Calvados, and people are like, all right, cool. So we knew, being in the U.S., that we knew that we sort of needed to have something in the agave space. There's three ways you could do that. You could either look for a brand, you could create a brand, or you could not have any of that product at all. Turns out that the agave distillates, the tequilas that we would have wanted to work with, they were already taken because nobody had waited for us. And we didn't want to settle for something that didn't meet our criteria. Instead of going, all right, well, we're gonna work with that brand, even though like they're not really as awesome as we would want to, since we want to be consistent with the mission of like not being flexible with quality and stuff, we said, all right, let's try to see if we, you know, have something made for us. And to be very frank with you, if you see the import game and the wholesale game is a lot about you work with a brand for a few years, and typically after like a 5-8 year cycle, sometimes sooner, a lot of brands feel like the grass is greener someplace else for no real reason. I mean, sometimes the importer or the wholesaler might not, you know, like do a fantastic job, but more times than not, it's just that idea that, you know, we should switch things around and the brand's moving someplace else. And that's a pain in the ass.
Or a brand could maybe get bought and different team come in and they don't have those relationships.
Now there's that. You're right. I mean, I was thinking from like 10 years ago or so, 8 years ago, but like for the past 4 or 5 years, 100%. Like a brand is going to reach some sort of like sales level and it's going to get sold, and new ownership brings that thing through their regular channels, and the small importer or small wholesaler usually gets a letter and says, all right, thanks a lot, but bye. So we for all those reasons, we said, all right, can we, not knowing anything about, you know, the tequila business really, can we try to make something happen? And in 2018, one of my friend and longtime PM employees, like the first person who trusted me 10 years ago, Leonardo Comercio, who was born and raised in Brooklyn and fluent in Spanish, came with me in 2018 in Mexico, in Jalisco. And we went to visit a few distilleries and talk to a few people. And that was our first attempt to like understand what it would take to maybe make that happen. And we ended up launching the first batch in 2021.
And with that was, because I read Jose Luis Gutierrez, he's someone that's worked a lot with producers sourcing, you know, high quality tequila for the European market. How did you guys, because he played a role in all this, how did you guys get connected with him?
Oh, that guy, Jose Luis is key, absolutely key. Like, as I said, this entire game is a people thing. It's a network thing. It's, you want to be working with like-minded individuals. Over 10 years ago, I was fortunate enough through a like really well-known sommelier, like visionary guy, who does a podcast, wine podcast called I'll Drink to That. His name is Levi Dalton. He was in New York. He did one of the very first sherry dinners in the city. I ended up discovering what sherry was. Through him, met some of the most important people in sherry in Spain. People who are sourcing single cask of sherry called Equipo Navazos. They're legendary producers, legendary independent bottlers, I should say. And one of the Equipo Navazos members, like a legit legend in the sherry world, told me 2016, 2017, told me, hey, there's that young guy, Jose Luis. He is in Madrid. He is into spirits as well. You should, you guys are like-minded individuals. For whatever it's worth, like, you guys should link up. Anything, like, you would enjoy each other's company. And Eduardo put us in touch. I did not have, at the time, like, a real agenda when it came to tequila. But knowing Jose Luis and understanding, like, who he was and what he was doing and why he was so connected as a Spaniard in the world of tequila, you know, it made it easy in my brain to connect the two. And when Leo and I decided that we needed a tequila, we should try to make a tequila happen. In my brain, I was like, all right, we should talk to Jose Luis. He's the dude who's going to help us make this a thing.
And he brings you guys to 1468 Grupo Tequilero Mexico. I personally believe this is a hidden gem of a distillery. They're capable of making some fantastic tequila. There's a handful of brands, small, not too many brands being made there. And there's like PM Spirits. There's a few others that are real standout. What was it like? Did you guys try different distilleries, or how did you end up at 1468?
I'll do like 2 minutes on José Luis to explain how we ended up at 1468.
Okay.
Because that dude is pretty special. And when I met him, he told me that story of how he got into tequila as a Spanish guy. And it turns out that in the mid-90s, his first job was at the Mexican embassy, first in the Netherlands and then in Madrid, as part of the trade commission and the and more specifically the food department within the trade commission of the Mexican embassy. And what's really relevant is that it was around like the year 95, 96. And that's around the time when the European Union was engaged with the Mexican government at recognizing the like Mexican appellations, and tequila was like the biggest one in Europe, and making sure that Mexico in return was recognizing some of the wine and spirits and food denomination of origin in Mexico.
Yep, okay.
So pre-mid-1990s, you would have a lot of tequila in Europe that was just made in Europe, and you would say tequila on it. And the fact that at the time in Europe, there were very few, you know, people of like Mexicans, and the Mexican embassy had a lot of Spanish people in there because obviously the language. And José Luis found himself at the right place at the right time. He was in Madrid in 96, and he was part of the team who was helping the tequila producers understand the European market as tequila had been recognized, or was going to be recognized, as a DO in Europe. And he was telling me, which I thought was pretty cool, even the CRT that was created in 94, I think, in Jalisco, when the CRT, the first office that the CRT had wasn't in Brussels, when it was like the first European office wasn't in Brussels, which is the capital of Europe, but it was in Madrid within the trade commission of the Mexican embassy. So this, it is how these people were linked, and how José Luis was working there at the time was so tied in with the tequila, with tequila makers and distilleries. So essentially, that dude built his network, having on one end the distillers, tequila distillers, coming to Spain to try to understand a European market, and having also European customers who used to be buying tequila, which wasn't real tequila, now looking for the real stuff that had the appellation of origin. So he built that network and realized that he could make a business out of it. So he was like one of those pioneers who just went on his own and started to, you know, connect people, essentially. So he has a pretty wide understanding of who makes what in Spain. I didn't have that understanding at the time. I trusted the guy. He introduced us to a few distilleries. Our conversations and the quality of the products that we tasted from Grupo Tequilero Mexico was pretty out there. They were very receptive with what we were trying to do, and we decided to give it a shot.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he was there from the beginning. Seems like he's got a pretty strong history, really seen a lot of the foundational things with denomination of origin and just being around there, just the right place for him to be able to build those relationships, and then for you guys to get connected with him. Everything about PM Spirits is small batch, high quality. This tequila blanco is no exception. This is small batch. Is it true each bottling is a product of one single oven? I mean, you guys are doing runs of this. It's not like this is just continually making this tequila. I'm going to have you walk us through the process, but this is pretty small batch.
We're not trying to make a brand.
Yeah.
So we don't have an agenda to grow this to like X tens of cases, X thousands of cases or whatever. Also, I'm not a trust fund baby. I'm completely self-founded. So I don't have a I don't necessarily have the dough to spend on like zillions of cases. And I'm coming from a place where I did not know anything about tequila. So when you do that and being an engineer, you're looking at the process, the steps, and you want to understand it in a pretty logical fashion. When we started to look at, you know, maybe having a tequila made for us, what most people that we started to talk to asked us, the first question wasn't like, what do you want to do? How do you want it to taste or smell like? They were like, all right, how many bottles do you want? What's the quantity? And I had no clue about quantities because I'm not going to say, hey, we're going to do like 100 cases or 100,000 cases. I had no idea. So I looked at the process and what felt logical to me was that the unit of production seemed to be the oven. Like you have this, the oven, one oven has a specific content, a specific amount of a specific weight of agave that it can fit depending on the size of the oven. And so as I looked at the process, my brain went to, you know, like, what's the size of an oven? Like how you're like taking to Grupo Tequila Mexico, like, all right, like how many, you know, tons of agave do you fit in there? And they said 30 tons. And I'm like, all right, I had no idea how much liquid that represents. So I said, all right, walk me through this. And the math sort of seemed to work out. I looked at it and was like, all right, I guess I can afford having an oven made. And so we started to do that, like the single oven type stuff, not to be fancy, or not to, you know, like, create a category that doesn't exist, but it's just you want to do something, you look at what is the logical unit to as far as quantity, and you look at if you can afford it, and that's sort of like an oven made sense.
So this is, like I said, small batch. Once a batch sells out, it's gone. I mean, until you produce another batch, it is gone. Have you done, I know you've done more than one batch, has it done a few batches, or are you doing a few a year, or is it still very, very limited?
It's very limited because we are still learning, and I have a sense that we're going to be learning for a long time. Going back to, like, we're not trying to create a brand, so I'm not spending hours and hours every day trying to make stuff happen for the PM yeah. Tequila. And as an indication, like, it doesn't even have a name. Like we don't, it doesn't have a brand name because we didn't know what to call it. So we're like, all right, it's going to be the PM Tequila, I guess. And that's what we went for, if that's an indication. So now we are, right now, we are at our, we released two batches. There is a third batch that we would have hoped was available now. It's not. Like everything that you do, that you are learning, things happen and then you learn from them. We're going through this iteration of, like, you know, it's a learning process. So like right now we're trying to figure out how we can get batch 3 to the US now that it's being produced, now that it has been produced. But we're working through all the different issues that one could when one starts such projects.
This is not, like I said, non-1468, a lot of traditional processes here for the production. Can you talk me through the production briefly of these? You've got two Blancos. You've got your standard 40%, and then you've got a still strength at 55, and those are virtually the same tequilas. One's just been proofed down. But can you talk to me a little bit about that process of making it?
Yeah, of course. So the original idea is to do one oven at a time. An oven is 30 tons of agave. There's cooking is 20 hours under heat, and then an additional 20 hours where the agave is rested. It's the agave is shredded. So I should mention that the corollo is removed. So like this.
Yeah, the bitterness is gone. Yep.
Correct. And then these agaves are shredded in a typical shredder fermentation. The yeast is a proprietary yeast that the distillery is using. Fermentation time is something that we kind of played around with a little bit, understanding that the speed and duration of fermentation is something that will impact tremendously the flavor profile of the stuff. So we're looking at doing different fermentation times to try to see like how it impacts that aroma and flavor profile. After fermentation is done, this is distilled in one of the three pot stills that Grupo Tequilero Mexico is operating. their copper stills. We have one distillate that we bottled at full proof, which is 55. Another one that it's that is bottled at 40%. Our aim is to use agave that are obviously fully ripe. We, after doing some research and talking to people who know a lot more about tequila than us, figured that 6 years is supposed to be about the average that the agave needs to be fully ripe and get to a decent amount of bricks, what we're looking for. As to why we have a 40% and a 55%, my team and I were discussing, you know, what should be the proof of the stuff. I like the stuff that's higher proof.
Yeah.
I think that whoever is going to buy things from us is enough of a grown-up to add his or her own water.
Okay.
At the same time, I understand the idea that 40% is a little more approachable and also it might be a little cheaper. And therefore, since we couldn't decide... Same idea as the, like, we couldn't find a name for it. Since we couldn't decide what the proof should be, we decided to do both. So the 40% is it's not going to sound too good, but it's like a watered down version of the 55.
Yeah, so it's proof down. It's just proof down a little bit. Yeah.
It's proof down. Oh, that's it sounds better. It sounds better. I appreciate that. What we aim at doing, once we will have our shit together and we will better equipped to put out batches a little more frequently, because right now it's like once a year and it's kind of almost laughable. We are going to our aim is to play around with stuff like looking at. I like to play around with fermentation. Like right now there's fermentation is 72 hours and then there's an additional 48 hours where the stuff is resting. So we're looking at 120 hours. Like what happened if that time is extended, or what happened if that time is shortened, for example. Yeah. Like these are things that could be cool to look at, but we are not there yet to give you an idea why the our third batch is, which should have been available now, is not. We were supposed to pick it up like 2 weeks ago and then it doesn't get picked up, and I'm like, all right, what's the what happens? What's happening? And I said, well, you know, we're talking to the authorities. They're looking at some stuff. Like we need to get something vetted. And then I end up being told where agaves were harvested when they were ripe. I'm like, all right, that's a good thing. Yeah, but they were ripe at 5 years and 7 months. I'm like, all right, well, that doesn't sound bad to me. Yeah, but the back label says agave age 6 year. Oh, yeah. Okay. So now we got the stuff that's in a ball. That stuff is labeled. That stuff is in boxes. But he can't leave Mexico. Okay. So what do we do now? How about we, you know, like carefully write 5 on top of the 6 on the back label and say, can't do that. And I'm like, all right, so...
Well, it says average age. It says average. And so average has to have a window of, length there.
That's my thought. But I'm not the person to convince here. There are others who need to say yes, and they're not saying yes. So now I'm like, all right, I guess the next step is that we need to remove the labels on everything, unbox, remove the labels, print new labels that says 5 year, and relabel everything. And my people at Grupo Tequila Mexico said, well, sadly, yes. So now that's what we're doing. And that it's the learning curve. Like, you know, we want to be super transparent. We want to have like as much info as we can on the products that we touch.
And that did, kind of bite you a little bit, but you do have a lot of information we're seeing that with some other really great tequilas. I see that with different mezcals where they're going, hey, there's transparency here. We're telling you average age, 6 years, average bricks, 35 for the bricks level, all of that stuff. But unfortunately that bit you a little bit here when something's a little off, but you guys aren't cutting corners. You're saying, hey, it's going to cost us more money. It's going to cost us time, but we're going to do it, and we're going to do it the right way. And so unfortunately you have to print new labels.
We want to do the right thing. We don't want to cut corners. we want to be transparent.
Yeah.
And it ends up, like, we're learning right now that it just takes more time and it takes more money, I guess. Because yeah, it'd be easier if it was just like some brand, like I would call that, like, I don't know, vampire, French vampire tequila, whatever that is. I don't know. And we put like no info whatsoever on the label. And that's easy. The reason why we created that little niche in the artisanal spirits game here in the US is because we have always followed the hard path. Like, we're the people who are tasked to import and wholesale the shit that's hard to sell. And we've been doing that for 12 years. I don't see why we should be trying to go down an easier route. So, you know, all right, we need to print new labels and get everything, like, relabeled. All right, so we're gonna do it. Is it ideal? No. It's not like the business is not relying on the PM tequila. We like it. We think it's cool. We think it looks good. We think it tastes good. It tastes good. I would much rather be able to sell it right now. I'm gonna be able to sell it in, you know, 4 weeks or 6 weeks. All right, it's fine. It's not gonna make or break the business. So.
Yeah, but here's the good news. There's a new batch coming out. And people do love this. When they can find this tequila, they are buying it. They're really enjoying it. These Blancos are fantastic. I mean, that agave, that sweetness, you know, those that mature, that Hybrix level, there's some citrus, there's some earthiness there, get some black pepper. And then when you go to that 55, it just takes everything up. I mean, I love still strengths. I love, like you, I love the higher proof. We have less water. We're going to get more flavor there. And both of these are fantastic. And if you can find them, but the good news is what you're saying here is, hey, there is a new batch that is going to be coming out. And so that is exciting. We've got to wait a little bit, but it is exciting because I'm in Florida and I see, I mean, there are stores that love carrying this. And when it comes in, people are quick to want to purchase it. You've got these two Blancos. I know this is not, you know, the main focus of building this brand, but with your background in barrels and French barrels and blending and things like that, is there any play to put some of the Blanco in barrels for the future for some age expressions?
I would like to. Again, we're learning. I clearly see with the products that I taste, the people we work with, the people who I talk to, it's obvious that the, like, aging in a country like Mexico is very particular. Yeah. And it happens at a speed that is higher than what I'm used to, which is, like, you know, Europe essentially. What I believe is that one needs to have one's shit together. If you start doing this, you need to be tasting really frequently. Yep. You need to be there a lot. You need to trust the people who are watching over those casks real quick. I don't know, but I would bet a dinner that they are a lot of very over-oaked, poorly aged tequilas out there. Because as soon as you start to have a pile of casks, if you're not tasting them every week or every 2 weeks, the stuff is going to suck pretty quickly. I don't want to do that. I don't have the capital, nor time, nor am I in Jalisco enough to be able to taste every week or so. Now, I would love to bring some Armenia cask and Cognac cask and Calvados casks and do a few things, but I need to have stuff lined up. I need to have it unlock enough that it's gonna lead to a good result. So I want to do it, but as long as I don't feel like I have the process tight enough, I'm not gonna venture into it.
Okay, that sounds fair. I mean, once you guys kind of really feel comfortable with it, there's a chance of it going down with your background for all of that. And then lastly, with this tequila, I do notice here on the label it says homage to Juan Antonio. Who's Juan Antonio?
Well, it was the person that I initially was introduced to via José Luis. He was the owner of Grupo Tequila Mexico. He is the person who, to a smaller extent, but like because of the language barrier, like I don't speak Spanish, sadly. He was the person who I started to interact with and learn from when it comes to tequila. He is the person who was heading Grupo Tequila Mexico for our first batch and then the trials that we did prior to that. He unexpectedly passed away after a heart surgery that didn't go too well in the beginning of 2022. And we ended up releasing our second batch only a few months after he had passed. And so now his daughter is Esmeralda is running the business, but it wasn't what was planned, obviously, by the families. So we wanted to again because this is it's a people business. Yeah. We are not making tequila. Like I am not making tequila. PM Spirits is not making tequila. A lot of brands are not making tequila. Like it's being made for them by people who are really gifted and whose job it is to make great product, and Juan Antonio was one of them. So we wanted to pay homage to the guy.
Yeah, it's beautiful way to show your respect for him and the relationship, what that meant for you as you got to know him for a little bit there. Nico, thank you for you and your team for going out and bringing back these amazing spirits to go all over and to source some of these amazing spirits. This tequila is fantastic. I know it's limited, and I know you've been very clear that your goal is not to build a massive tequila brand, but if you're able to find a bottle of the PM Spirit tequila, pick it up, buy it. You will not be disappointed. You're also working with some other amazing Mexican spirits brands importing. We've had Neta, Cinco Sentidos. Those are agave distillates that lean more in that mezcal world. Those are both incredible distillates. And then you also have a Oaxacan rum that I need to try to get my hands on. Is that another one? You guys were able in a place where you could taste it and see it, and you just thought, wow, this is something that hits all of those points that we're going after for a Mexican rum?
This is a project by Jason Cox.
Oh, okay. He has told me a little bit. Okay, so it's the same one that he's working with.
Yeah. So this is Jason who owns Cinco Sentidos, who was on your podcast. Jason has an extremely good palate. He has a very clear vision of what he wants to achieve. We've been very proud to import Cinco Sentidos, as we're proud to import Neta. Through Jason, we ended up importing Ixcateco, which is originally was a Papalo melt under the Cinco Sentidos brand. That okay. Jason very kindly helped the Mezcalero to develop his own brand, and benefiting from his knowledge. And he set him up with us. And Jason had this idea of how Oaxaca could generate pretty big rums. And I've been fortunate enough that Jason has been, sending samples, and we've been discussing, like, it's 100% Jason projects. I don't mean to make it sound like I'm involved in any other capacity, but like I've had samples, and we've had back and forth as to like what do you think about this and that and the other, and every time Jason come up with one of his casks or one of his blends, I'm like, this is really good, and that's what he called that Alambique Serrano, and these are Mexican rums that are pretty out there, tropically aged. Some of these casks are like right there.
I was reading, he's got like three different cellars, three different ways of where he's aging those barrels and different elevations, and one just in nature. I mean, just some pretty interesting things that they're doing there.
You have casks that are in the jungle. Like you're literally walking, and there's trees and stuff, and boom, you have casks that are stacked up and just under a tree. And it's just incredible. And the flavor profile of these things is really remarkable. And we were talking about products that have a personality, and these display that. And you've seen, I mean, you're an expert a lot more than me, when it comes to like agave things, like, you've tasted the Nitta, you've tasted the Cinco Sentidos, these things are, they're special. There's a lot of other products that are special. I'm not saying like, but like these things are special. Like they have a personality, and Alambique Serrano, like that, Jason's new project is in line with that stuff.
Well, it sounds like, I've got some more stuff to talk to Jason about. May have to bring him back on as we dive into some Oaxacan rums there.
Got to reach out.
Nico, thank you for coming on the show. If people want to learn about PM Spirits, they can go to pmspirits.com and they can learn not just about just the tequila, but all the spirits that you guys are working with. What's the best way for people to keep up with you, social media, things like that, if they want to keep up and see what you've got going on?
Well, we are trying to have a multi-platform outreach on social media, but we started like 3 weeks ago to really be serious about it.
Okay.
IG is probably the best way, at PM Spirits.
Okay.
This is where one would learn what we have going on, but we're trying to be relevant a little bit on from Twitter to Facebook to even maybe TikTok, even though I feel too old for that stuff. But at PM Spirits on your social platforms, and you should be able to find us.
Perfect. Well, there you have it. Nico with PM Spirits. Thank you again. Thank you for all that you're doing, and thank you for coming on the show. Cheers and salute, my friend.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Nicolas Palazzi with PM Spirits. To learn more about the brands he works with, you can go to pmspirits.com and keep an eye out for the latest batch of PM Spirits Tequila Blanco. As always, big thanks to siptequila.com. You can find more Agave content on my social media platforms at Agave Social Club. I'm Doug Price, and thanks for listening.